Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. People that are new to the practice of meditation probably for quite some time wonder why it is they're doing what they've been instructed to do. Might take a bit of time for it to sort of click or make sense in any real way. But after a while, it soon registers that this mind is no simple thing. Is no simple thing to connect with. This mind has a mind of its own, and we soon become aware that when we have to simply just look, quieten the whole situation down, and just simply look at this mind or look at ourselves, look and see what our situation is, to try and get some sort of handle on who we are, get some sort of fix on our consciousness, it soon becomes very clear how difficult it is just to really look and see what this mind is. This mind connected to all its systems, the feelings, how much we're influenced by feelings, what they're doing to us all the time. When we think we're making clear, precise decisions, how much we're influenced just by feelings in the mind, feelings in the body. How much sort of basic interference there is, how much is going on all the time. Generally, we're not conscious of just how complicated this situation is. The last rains I spent in Thailand in a Thai monastery, and it was it's quite an interesting situation there. Very nice place in central Thailand, Chon Buri. We used to go on the Pindabat, the alms round, every day, every morning. And at the time there, they were fertilizing the fields. And they'd got the lorries had been coming in and delivering this whole sort of piles of this chicken dung manure. And so, a certain area you passed through these fields, there were these huge, great piles of this manure, chicken dung manure, and this attracted flies, and it was quite interesting that you knew when you were coming close to this, because firstly it was in the air, you could scent it in the air. But more noticeable was these flies. And as you would get closer to these piles, then the flies would get more and more intense, and they'd land on your face, anywhere where you had any bare flesh, they would land on you, and really lots of them. And I mean, in the fly season here in Perth, flies get quite bad, so you know roughly the sort of thing I mean. But this was really most intense. It's not the sort of it's not quite so bad normally in that area, but just on this occasion it was extremely bad, these flies. And this was happening for a few days, and I would just notice that I'd be walking along, and I start getting involved in these sort of conscious sort of throwbacks of situations that had happened to me in the past, sort of very negative things. And some of these things had happened quite some time ago, some of them quite recently. And I'd find myself getting very irritated and very annoyed. And then suddenly I'd almost start sort of losing my temper. And I say, I have to catch myself suddenly, you know, relax. Cool it. You know, what's all the fuss about? What's all the fuss about? And after a while, it would go away. And this was happening to me on a few occasions for a few days. And I started to ask myself, so then I'd be coming back again from the arms round. And I thought to myself, well, this is the point now. What was it yesterday? I came past this point yesterday. What was it I was getting so upset about? And and then I noticed that as I was getting closer to this piles of chicken dung, then these flies were becoming more and more noticeable, and I started getting irritated with these flies. And what I hadn't connected was that. Suddenly I would start getting into these mental squabblings again. And I began to see that what it was, and I wasn't paying attention to this, that it was the flies that were irritating me. The flies were just flying all over my face. I'd be knocking them away. They'd be coming back. They'd be all over my head, all over the back of my neck. And what was happening was this consciousness was just getting irritated by these flies, but it wasn't fully paying attention to the flies. It was getting caught up in the aversion. And this aversion, this consciously translated into old negative situations. So what consciousness was doing was, consciousness was being excited by discontent, aversion. And it was manufacturing these thought forms so that it could actually use these thought forms to manifest its anger. And so this was very interesting. There was something in me, this frustration, wanted some sort of outlet to deal with the situation. So sort of consciousness there for the use of was conjuring up these mental formations, these structures that were sort of in the memory banks, in the psyche, of negative situations that had happened before, and really making a big deal out of it, bringing them up, so that it could actually get angry and annoyed and attack these situations, things that had happened or people. And it wasn't until I suddenly realized that I was almost losing my temper about situations that happened before, which I'd never done before. And I suddenly realized I'd been completely duped by these flies, which I hadn't been paying attention to. I'd just been knocking them away, and I hadn't seen in a very subtle way this consciousness was, in a way, it was using the situation. It was feeding on this situation, and it was just showing that this facility or this faculty of consciousness and aversion, how aversion actually stays in being by feeding. it needs to feed. You know, there's a feeling of anger. There's something about anger that is actually quite juicy, and it's emotional. There's this build up of emotion. I mean, and this is a very strong, a very intense contact emotion. We tend to sort of go out towards emotion. If it's not pleasant emotion, then unpleasant emotion. You know, it's the involvement. We just tend to get involved in any sort of emotion, and it has a momentum of itself. It's self-engendering, self-replicating. You get caught into a momentum, and it isn't you there. You know, there isn't any person there. It is just simply a process, and you realise that, you know, this is what anger is. This is why anger stays in being. It feeds. Whenever you're feeding anger, you're always reseeding it. You're always replanting the seed. It's always, even if it's from a long time ago, you know, it'll stay there. And it's ready, you know, from years and years ago, that seed is there. You know, if you sort of nourish it and stimulate it and water it in the present, it's quite happily you come back into being. And so that was that situation was a very obvious one, on that occasion. The way anger accommodates consciousness. I mean, it isn't us. Consciousness isn't us. It is here. It arises, and as such, it's a liability because it needs to be contained. And if you get caught into a negative circuit, then you're no longer involved. There is just the process. If you could try to find where you are in this, is just this consciousness, this awareness that you're chasing something. You're trying to get something. There is a sense of volition. You know, in consciousness there is a sense of I am. In volition, there is a sense of I am. In emotion, there is a sense of I am. I'm trying to get something. I'm trying to get something to satisfy me. And in these negative anger patterns, you're trying to find some sort of satisfaction, some way of dealing with a situation that is causing you discontent. So the next day, after realizing, like what had been happening was, for a few days I'd been getting back to the monastery, and I'd been feeling absolutely wretched, absolutely worthless. You know, here I am, a practicer of meditation, loving kindness, and all the qualities one goes into a monastery to cultivate. And after all these years, now I'm getting caught up in these situations. I'm so easily duped by these situations? You know, so then I'd start sort of hitting myself, thinking how hopeless I am, wasting my life. You know, what am I doing? What have I been doing all these years? I still can't identify this situation and deal with it. Now, and of course, then that is another part of the process. You know, that's the comeback. That's the side effect of it is the guilt. And I am hopeless. And so, meanwhile, you're still trying to contain this momentum, saying, "Hang on. Okay, it wasn't skillful in getting involved in those negative anger emotions, but at the same time, I'm still caught up in the cycle. I'm still caught up in the momentum because now I'm getting the guilt of doing that. You know, this is just such a common process. people behave in a negative way, a violent way, and then there's the remorse and the regret and the feeling worthless. I mean, this is such a human trait. I mean, everybody experiences this, you know, especially with people, people we love, people that are friends of ours. You know, people that you love, people that are friends of yours can still make you very angry at times. Anger, very, very difficult thing to control. So sometimes we do act very skillfully, do things and say things that, you know, we regret, and because it's people that we care about. We've hurt people that we care about. So then we go into remorse, grief, and regret. But of course, that is still, it's still the same process, but the other end, the other pole. So I had to sort of see this, you know, say, wait a minute, now hold on, no, just stop, just get back here, you know, just get back here. What is the situation here and now? You know, where are things at? And so after a while, things, you know, gradually after a while petered down, the whole momentum slowed down and it leveled out. And so I thought, well, tomorrow, I'm not going to let this happen again. This is absurd. You know, I'm going to be ready for it. I'm going to be waiting for it. You know, it's just a case, you know, if you're conscious of a situation, if you're conscious that you're going to be hit, then it doesn't hurt so much. If you're aware of the situation, then, you know, then whatever the situation happens, however tough it gets, as long as you maintain consciousness of just being right there with it, not getting pulled off guard, not getting thrown off balance, not getting knocked down. Or if you get knocked down, you're up again there. So this time when I left the monastery, I was ready for it, ready for the dung heap, ready for the flies. And so off I started trundling into the fields, and so after a while, you know, at first you could sense, you could smell this chicken deposits in the air long before you got there. And I could see this whole mounting ahead of me, this manure. And then, of course, then one or two flies, and then more. Then they started building. I started saying things like, why is it when there are these huge mountains of chicken dung, why are flies flying on me? And, well, I mean, they're here because of the chicken dung. You know, why aren't they on that? Why are they on me? Stupid fly. Hold it. Now watch it. Flies can do whatever flies do. What has it got to do with you? It's pointless you trying to tell a fly how it should behave, how it should run its life. Let a fly be a fly. Pointless trying to train a fly. Pointless going to pieces and getting upset, losing your temper because you can't train a fly. Okay, fine, right. Flies are landing on me. They prefer me and not the chicken dung. Fine. I don't know why. I washed yesterday. So then, of course, as I'm coming, then when they begin to see I was an easy touch, I wasn't knocking them away, that was it. Vroom. They were just... I must have looked black... as I was walking along, just totally covered in this very interesting sensation. I mean, like, no, just the feeling of these flies walking up the back of your neck is absolutely infuriating. You know, there's this feeling that, you know, don't they realise they're not supposed to do that, you know? Don't they know it's very irritating? Why are they doing that? And it's just amazing. Every time, the same feelings would come back. And all, even though I said, no, they're just flies, they'd land on me. And what I could see, after a while, what I could see was that I was the victim of an automatic process. Although I was making an effort to be consciously there, as soon as I would have a contact with these flies, or a contact with me, and they'd land on my face and walk about, there was this same reaction, this aversion for these flies would come in, this feeling of intense dislike, this indignation, this frustration, which was, I could see, was a very deep-set thing. And I would have to stop. Hang on, wait a minute. You know, you made a determination. That's right. Now, just seconds ago, I accepted that I was going to allow these flies to be flies. But I got caught in this rut, this ongoing rut, which was, you know, which were basic sort of structures of my personality. And I was seeing here that I, you know, although I was consciously trying to remain in control, I was suddenly tuning in to these basic ruts where I just wasn't in control. It was just the anger, irritation, aversion, ruts. And this was amazing. And this was happening all along. You know, just seconds afterwards, the more flies would come and it'd be getting worse. And this is ridiculous. It's stupid flies. You know. And he was blaming them as if these flies were deliberately doing this when they knew they shouldn't. They were doing it because they were deliberately upsetting me, because they knew the dung was over there and I was over here, and they were getting a big kick at irritating me. And there was this feeling. You know, there was actually this feeling that these flies were deliberately irritating me. And I'd say, well, what do you, you know, why? Why do you think that? What are you basing that on? Why do you believe that? And I say, well, I don't actually believe it. Then why did I think it? And I could see that there was this, you know, there was this recording. There was this recording that would play back in this fashion. It would play back in this fashion based on irritation, annoyance, and stupid sort of childish reactions. You know, these childish reactions that we gain when we're children, you know, they're very difficult to shake them. You know, they not only do they remain there, but they get deeper. And you think the child is gone, but that child is still there. It's just disguised, you know. Like, you know, when adults get upset with adults get into fights. A lot of the time, it's children fighting, you know. But you know, but they're using the words and behaviour and action of adults, you know. But some of it can be based on still the most simplest, silly things that kids squabbled over in the nursery. And, you know, and I realise, you know, that it's a lot of my behaviour is still there. And it's actually, it isn't actually justified of me to say to myself, I should be better than this. I should be beyond this. I've done all this practice for all these years. I should have eradicated this. And that isn't the case. The truth of the matter was, it was the practice I'd done for the last 15, 16 years that had just brought me to that point of seeing how serious the condition was. You know, just to be able to recognise it and realise, you know, it's no easy matter, you know. You know, and just you tend to think, but just by living in a monastery and living the life of a monk, something automatically is happening, that you're just putting in the time in. Just putting the time in is enough to clear, you know, to clear this away. It isn't the case. I mean, you can spend your whole life in a monastery, but if you're not consciously, actively aware of the practice you're supposed to be doing, you can be wasting a lot of time. And it really is a job, you know, being a monk is hard work, and the work is mindfulness, this sati, you know, that is the job a monk has to do, you know? That's how he earns his bread, you know. If he's not doing that, then, you know, then is he really earning his rice? Because I realize, you know, then just to say, you know, I shouldn't get angry, that was pointless. It's got nothing to do with it. Anger is part of the system. The interesting, I was reading just recently, Dalai Lama saying, you know, one of the problems he has, one of the things he has the greatest difficulty with is anger. You know, he says, you know, that really is, you know, that really is something that he's having to deal with the whole time. You know, and it's the Dalai Lama. So, you know, it's a bit arrogant to think I should, you know, overcome anger in half a dozen years of supposedly pure living. But anyway, we do we do have a lead into this. We do have a cue. This is the purpose, you know, to get any sort of lead on this without having a basic practice of mindfulness, you know, the meditation, then it's very difficult. You know, never doubt. For so long, I know, I used to always be asking myself, you know, what is the point of this meditation? Is it working? You know, have I changed? Am I any different? What am I supposed to be doing? You'd sit and watching the breath year after year, and then still you'd reach a point to say, why am I doing this? What's the point? Am I doing it right? Is it really that simple? I mean, watching the breath, must be more than that, watching the breath. What's watching the breath got to do with it? You know, it still happens occasionally. Anyway, if it's any help, never doubt it. Never doubt it. Every moment you're putting in, all the sitting that you're putting in, all the hours you're putting in, it's very necessary. Because purely and simply, you have no choice. You have to be able to get a handle. You have to get a perspective on this mind, because it is wild. You know, it's not there. It's not there for your benefit. You have to actively. You have to actively get involved and change the shape of this psyche, this situation, you know, because it'll just go on forever. It'll just go on forever like this. It is definitely a matter of training, or more precisely, a matter of seeing, a matter of observation. This sati is just so important. You need to have a constant practice of sati the whole time. Any little practice that you can schedule during the day, so that as many times as possible, just if there are things, even if you have an alarm that you put on any time during the day, so that stop at this, when the alarm goes off, stop and ask yourself, where are you at? You know, am I being mindful? You know? Just suddenly, at any moment, just stop and get a cross-section. You know, any time of the day, just get a cross-section of what's happening in the mind, where you're at, what's actually happening. Are you doing it? Are you doing it? Or is it doing it? Is it doing it to you? You know, what are you caught up in? Or just observe that momentum. You know, in this day and age, it's more difficult for people than it's ever been. You know, the momentum of life. This busy day, Western society. You know, we got lots of modern conveniences which make life easier in one way, but at the same time, we do have actually less space where the mind can actually, in its own way, get a chance just to calm down, just to quieten down. And unless the mind gets that opportunity just to be quiet and just to be still, then it's very difficult to see the situation, because it's only a still mind that allows the wisdom to actually be able to see the situation, any time to be able to see where you're at, to see that momentum. Because when that momentum is actually going, when you're caught up in that, when you're involved in a project, then it's very difficult to actually keep a still mind when you get really involved in a project. And basically what's happening, the mind does this. The mind doesn't want to be still. In fact, the samsaric mind, you know, the mind of what we call the aggregates, the khandhas, they are basically dynamic. They are activity. They are restless. They don't like being still Consciousness doesn't like being still. It doesn't like being quiet. Mental formations don't like being still. They like to be, structured. They like to be in dynamic. They like to move around. They like activity. They like excitement. They like drama. They like theatrics. All sorts of scenarios. They like fantasy. They like entertainment. But of course, are you really present when all this is going on? It's very difficult to be present when there's just so much activity going on in the mind. And since we're just addicted, to entertainment. And gradually over the years, over the centuries, we've become more addicted to entertainment. Now, it's today, entertainment is big business. Walt Disney, it's Star Wars and all of these things, get adults. You get adults queuing up in video stores. Great queues and queues and queues of adults getting Star Wars videos. Just amazing. I was reading in the paper a short while back the director, is it the top director of Disney. His profits after tax for one year's profits after tax were $580 million. That's after he'd paid everything for 1 year. His profits, his personal profits, $580 million. Of course, there was a side effect to this. He had a quadruple bypass in his heart. Had a lot of money, but he didn't have a heart. Had a plastic heart. So, I don't have much money, but I think I think I'd rather have a heart than all his millions. But anyway, what it indicates is, basically, this is the age of entertainment. In other words, it's doing it for you. Let that entertainment business do it for you, and you just tune into that, and you let yourself go. You give up on it. But where are you? A lot of entertainment is all based on sensuality and violence. It's great stuff to feed on, isn't it? Consciousness loves to feed on that. Anger and violence. But the truth of the matter is, violence breeds violence. And so, if you live in a community where there's violence, or you're brought up with violence, then you'll tend towards violence. If you allow yourself to get involved in violence, then that simply is a thing that is breeding. What you do regenerates. We have this saying in Buddhism that if you have craving, becoming. We use this term, becoming. It's upadana paccaya bhavana. Where you get involved in something, what you do and what you cling to, then it reproduces. And that's it, basically. Activity reproduces itself because it's a momentum. You're getting a momentum going, and as long as you continue that momentum, it will keep going. And of course, the whole way out of this, the reverse of this, is stillness. You have to quieten things down. So you have to know entertainment for what it is. You have to see it. You have to see through that. And once you're caught up in these activities, then the amount of control, the amount of wisdom that you can exercise in seeing how negative emotions arise, is very limited. Is very limited indeed. What is most precious for you is for you to be able to get a fix on consciousness. For you to consciously be the element in consciousness which is directing consciousness, so that activities are something that you are allowing or you're not allowing. In other words, when consciousness is doing its own thing, it's acting in a way by default. This whole system that you could say, this whole system that comes into being, this whole structure comes into being in a way by default. You know, even the whole, not only the whole mental mechanism, you could say the whole animal organism. In a sense, it's not a design. You know, it's not a design that's been thought up by some great being. It comes about, you could say, it develops and evolves by default because it isn't a wisdom production. It comes around through very base instincts of hunger and violence and survival. As we become human beings, and the consciousness becomes more refined, then we get a glimpse into this. We get a glimpse into the basic animal nature that we're up against. You know, the Greeks have the stories of the centaurs. The centaurs are half animal, half man, and half animal. These centaurs are always fighting with men. There's always, in Greek mythology, there's always these battles between man and the centaurs. And what this is representing is that the centaurs are the side of man which is still sort of the animal, half animal. And the full man represents the full human being, which has access to a higher consciousness of a more refined spiritual nature. But the centaur is still the animal in us, which is trying to take over the human being. So there's this battle going on in us all the time, because really we are, you know, if you you care to be honest about this, and what is the difference, you know, physically, you know, as organisms, as bodies, what is the real difference between us and animals? You know, think of all the items on your body that other animals have. When we might be a slightly different shape, but you know, basically we've been referred to as the naked ape, or we're just a dog that stands up on its hind legs. But you know, like I think it, with a gorilla, the gene makeup of a gorilla is 98% the same as a human being. Now, I didn't make that up. I read it in the paper. I mean, that blew me over. You know, I mean, I knew gorillas looked a bit like people, looked a bit like, you know, human beings, but they're actual. In other words, we're only 2% different from a gorilla. You know, so you see what we're up against. But of course, that 2% is relevant. It's important because that is giving us access to the spiritual realm. We can get beyond this. We can get beyond the animal nature. And because, of course, a Buddha has arisen in the world and has gone beyond, we know that organisms now have reached the pinnacle of their development. Organisms now have superseded just being basically animal and nothing else, and have reached the high consciousness, which can go totally beyond existence, totally beyond this problem of having to survive, having to battle with all these basic instincts, you know, which are love and hate, you know, which are, you know, really are a problem. They're a liability. You're hating the world and loving the world, you know, and the world's hating you and loving you half the time. You know, it doesn't love you all the time. It doesn't hate you all the time, thank goodness. But this battle, you know, is going on, and there is no end to it in itself. But there is a way out, because within these khandhas, within this structure, there is the path out. Consciousness has refined itself to such an extent, or it always has been that refined, but now we've reached a situation where we can have access to the consciousness which can be a pure consciousness, which can go beyond this situation. We have glimpsed the way out. The Buddha has shown us that we have reached a point that there is a way out, but we have to work very hard. And Buddha makes no bones about this. Have to work very hard. You know, you have to believe it is possible. You have to believe that the Buddha did find the way out. He found the way beyond this earthly toil, out of samsara, to total release, total freedom, total liberation. And so that's the good news. I think at this point I'll just stop, because I've been told that this is long enough, and maybe people might like to ask some questions at this point. You don't have to answer questions. I've still got 15 minutes left. Okay, what I'll do. Nobody's going to ask any questions. Right. I'd just like to tell a quick story of a friend of mine. I got various stories of various friends of mine, which I find quite entertaining, these stories. So I'd just like to mention the friend of mine, Dennis. Right? Now, Dennis was a career man. He worked for the Lambeth Borough Council. Now, I don't know if anybody's ever heard of the Lambeth Borough Council, but that's in London. It's like that's the biggest borough in London. And when he joined the council and worked there many years, and he was a career man. His whole interest was in his work. He's very dedicated. And he soon got caught up in the system, and after a while, this actually became his life. Just everything the council stood for, he really believed in it. You know, he initiated all sorts of projects, did lots of positive things. But what he was most concerned with was actually rising up in the hierarchy, you know, bettering himself, getting promotions, getting more money, getting status. And this is a big thing. This is a big thing. Even in London Borough Council, you know, this goes on. I couldn't believe it. You know, all the things you're telling me, all the struggles and battles and intrigues and personality clashes, the things, you know, you could write a whole sitcom. A whole soap opera around it, you know, what goes on in a simple, mundane London Borough Council. Anyway, he was saying that, you know, this whole plan he had for advancing himself, and you know, gradually, you know, his life went by, you know, and he gradually got more and more promoted. He got higher and higher, doing better for himself, but you know, more promotion, in charge of more projects, in charge of quite large sums of money. How large sums of money would be spent organising situations and institutes in London and thing. But then after a while, he realised that, you know, there were certain people in his way. It was always whatever he got, whatever level he reached, his eyes were always on the next level. You know, he was never content. He was never happy. It was always about, there was always this contention, and it was sort of felt that all these people, there was this struggle, all these heads of departments, in a sense, they were all competing with each other. And so there was this struggle. It was always this struggle going on. And so he was making his way up gradually, and he got quite good at this. He got quite clever in manipulating his way through the system, and getting higher and higher. And he'd sacrificed everything for this. You know, his whole identity became this London, this Lambeth borough council. His whole identity was caught up with it. It was him. He put everything into it. It was so meaningful to him. And until he just had this one ambition to be the number one sort of director of the Lambeth Borough Council. And then he became obsessed with this idea. This was always eating away at him, getting that number one position. And so, after years and years and years, he managed to get right. He got right to the top, except for one position. And this, he was in his early 50s by this time. So he knew once he got this position, that was it. You know, that was his career was clinched. Nothing more to worry about. It was the best possible position. Great power for a long time, with an incredible pension at the end of it, retiring whenever he wanted to, and so this was it. This was all that stood between him now and the top position. There was just this one man, this one man in this top position. But it just so happened that this man in this top position was a younger man than my friend Dennis. And this, was, of course, a bit of an obstacle. And so, and Dennis, he would try all these manoeuvres and manipulations to try in some way oust this character from his position. And this character would all the time be trying to undermine Dennis in very subtle ways, making things look bad for him, projects he was doing, not giving him support with them, blocking funds for his particular projects so that things he would get involved with wouldn't turn out right. And there would be this sort of, he was in the very, very subtle battles. You know, nothing you could point your finger at, but everybody knew about it. And they all had their sort of aides, their own teams that would be trying to work against the others. And get Dennis, Dennis's team was trying to get Dennis at the top. But after a while, what came out of this was it got so intense that after a while, Dennis just absolutely loathed this character in the top position, absolutely hated him. Everything he did at board meetings, it was always this horrible, stony atmosphere. He would never agree with any suggestion, any proposal would make. Whatever proposals or suggestions they would make, the other one would automatically veto it. It's a bit of a problem in the system. But anyway, there was just this loathing going on. And then anyway, one day, there's a message for Dennis. Could he go to so-and-so's office? Could he go and see so-and-so in his office? This is the boss. This is the one, the head one. And Dennis thought, oh, this is it, right. It's going to showdown now. And if he's going to try this, I'm going to try that. I've got him. I know I can get him. I can get him. Whatever he pulls, I know he's going to try and cut a deal, but I've got him. He's out. I'm going to get him. I've got support. So this fella said, morning, Dennis. Nice to see you. Come in. We've been discussing latest policies and new moves in the department, and we've come to a unanimous decision, and we've decided that everybody over 50 is redundant. And Dennis said, and that's final. There's nothing you can do about it. You're out of a job. Goodbye. And that was it. So can you see the beauty of this? I mean, can you see the irony of it? Dennis, poor Dennis, his whole life. This was his life. The borough council was his life. He put everything into it. Everything in his life was this big, was all for this big moment when he was going to be number one. And so everything he'd ever done, all the effort, all the work he'd done, had come to absolutely nothing. You know, all his plans, all his hopes, his whole life, right there was cut off at that instant. And he was out of work, you know. Gave him a measly pension, you know, nothing compared to the pension he was, you know, he had in mind. You know, the castles he'd planned on building in Spain or wherever. And that was it, you know, and he was literally out of work. And he said that for the next 2 years, for the next 2 years, he was in a state of depression, absolute depression. He just couldn't get this character out of his head. This hatred for this character, it's all, that's all he lived. The next thing, you know, after all these years working to be number one in the Lambeth Borough Council, you know, then that was followed by these 2 years of just depression and hatred. And it literally took him 2 years. And then he got involved. Luckily, he then got involved with the Dharma class and some meditation. And after a while, we managed to pull Dennis out of this and get into to see things in a different perspective. So now, because the thing is, when Dennis is telling you this story, it's a struggle to keep a straight face, you know, because you just want to burst out with laughing all the time. it's just so sort of typical, you know. It's just so classic, such a classic story of, you know, just life. You know, just the way life is. And that, you know, in other words, Dennis was living a delusion. He wasn't enjoying being, you know, alive. He wasn't enjoying the work. It was all for the future. Everything he was doing, he wasn't living in the moment. He wasn't there with his act. He wasn't actually getting any pleasure out of being. Just his everyday existence. You know, it didn't exist. It was all just this fantasy, this idea of what he was going to be in the future. You know, which never actually happened. It never happened. And that's, you know, that is just such a perfect illustration, you know, where so many people get caught up, you know, just in a momentum where you're just not here, you know. I think, you know, the day people die, you know, this must be, even though it's never happened to me, this must be just such a definite, obvious thing that happened. If the day you die and you suddenly realize you're about to die, you must just instantly think to yourself in terms, well, die from what? You know, what was that? Where have I just come from? You know, who was I? You know, and try to think, you know, actually try to focus for a moment, what was life? Just one situation where I can actually focus on and say, well, that was me, that was the life I've just lived in, you know. Because, you know, if the whole thing is always in a state of momentum, a movement, and moving on, and expectations and plans, you know, where was your life? You know, where did it happen? You know, suddenly you realize you've been duped. You know, you were always doing something, you were always going somewhere, you were always planning something, you were always constructing something, you were always making something that was taking you away from actually being alive this moment. You know, you're actually here now, you know. If it isn't happening now, if you're not appreciating it now, if you're not getting the benefits now, then why should you get it in the future? You've got more chance of being here, getting, you know, sampling the gold here, the flavour here, the taste here. Get the most out of here while you're here. You know, make the most out of this moment, because future might not happen. You know, it might just disappear. Why waste now? You know, whatever it is, it might not be much, you know, but it's better than not having it. I mean, since you've got it, you might as well appreciate it. And the more attention you pay to it, then the more you'll appreciate it. You know? Because the more sati you have, the more you are here, then the more you get out of this moment. You know? And really, the truth is that this moment is vast. This moment is endless. Now, can anybody indicate to me where this moment ends? You know? Is it the universe? Is it the other end of the universe? You know, how far is the other end of the universe? That's happening at this moment, isn't it? The other side of the cosmos, I don't know how far away it is. I know it's a long way away, but it's happening at this moment. You know, it is vast, isn't it? You know? And the consciousness that is conscious of that, you know? Well, you know, if that consciousness is capable of conceiving that in this moment, then this consciousness at this moment must be vast by definition, isn't it? You know, so isn't there enough here for entertaining? You know, do you need any more than this? In fact, isn't there far more here, you know, than you could possibly want, than you're ever likely to appreciate? I mean, you can only really appreciate it the more you actually practice and cultivate and develop true attention and appreciation of this moment here. You know, because there's such a great deal going on, isn't there, at this really moment. Now, if you had to, at this moment now, if you had to list all the things that you're conscious of in this moment, you know, in this room, all the things that are happening in this room, just the sight, you know, the endless shapes and colours and situations and implications and things that are going on, just in one instant of looking, all the things I can see here, too vast for me to take in, but at the same time, something is taking all this in, you know. There is a vastness which is readily available to us here if we just bring, you know, if we just bring focusing consciousness and be happy, you know, and contented with just this and not wanting to go beyond just this which is here. You know, that's good enough for me. You know, you try it. You know, I don't care about the next second. Well, I do, it's this second. Or the next second. Or, you know, or the next minute. Doesn't matter. This is enough. Plenty in it. Far more than I need. I mean, more than Disneyland, isn't it, really? Okay, well, I think that's taken us to the allotted time. Okay, so that's fine. Nice to see everybody.